Hello, Juan. This is Jackie's father, Herb, or otherwise known as Joseph and Sam's grandpa. And as you know, Jackie asked me to tell some things to you about what people today call the Depression. But when I lived during those times, people called it the Great Depression. Why the difference? Because it affected so many millions and millions and millions of people. So, before I answer Jackie's questions, I think it makes good sense to explain what the world was like, what life was like some 70-odd years ago. And I'll do my best to make this picture come alive and then talk about the Depression, the Great Depression. I was born in the year 1927. I am going to be, in a few months, 74 years old. In 1927, the year I was born, the Depression had not yet started. The biggest event in 1927 was when a man named Charles Lindbergh, who was an airplane pilot, flew his plane nonstop from Long Island, that's just a little bit away from New York City, flew his plane across the North Atlantic Ocean. And I don't remember how many days it took, how he stayed awake all that time, but successfully landed on a rainy day at an airfield in Paris, France. It was one of the great landmarks of history that a human being flew an airplane so far and navigated and carried gasoline and safely landed. He was a great hero of his time. And people all over the world were amazed. There were very few people in 1927 who had actually ever seen an airplane, believe it or not. The reason is that the airplane, the first one to fly, the one that was built by the Wright brothers, that's Orville and Wilbur Wright, spelt W-R-I-G-H-T, was built, or let's say invented, if you will. It was invented in 1904. So by 1927, the airplane was still a very new thing, and there were very few of them. They first appeared as in a world war, World War I. Automobiles, well, there weren't very many people who owned automobiles. They were much too expensive for the average person. That didn't mean that if you didn't own an automobile, you were poor, or if you did own an automobile, you were rich. It just meant that they were also quite new, and people wouldn't even know how to drive them, and there wasn't a road system that made it practical for most people to own a car. One of the questions that Jackie asked me to answer was, where did I live during the Great Depression? Well, Juan, I was born in New York City. In New York City, very few people lived in privately owned homes, such as yours, or Jackie's and David's. Most people lived in rather tall apartment houses. As many as 50 or 60 families lived in one building, and they had perhaps two bedrooms and a bathroom, and sometimes they didn't have a bathroom. You might have to share it with another family. And each apartment opened onto a hallway where there was a staircase that would take you down to the street. There were very few apartment houses in the Bronx, New York, where I lived, that had elevators. If a building was five stories high, it didn't have to have an elevator. That was the law. If a building was six stories or taller, then the landlord, the owner, had to have a working elevator. So most of the buildings only went five stories. So every time you went out and you went shopping for food, you would have a long walk up, especially if you lived on the top floor. My best memory is, as a boy, we lived on the second floor of an apartment house during the Depression years. Let me tell you how things were. There was no such thing as a shopping mall. If you wanted to buy, let's say, some pasta, you went to a store that sold nothing but pasta. Usually, the store was owned by a little Italian family, and generally speaking, they made the pasta themselves in the rear of the store. If you wanted to buy fish, you went to a fish store. Nothing else was sold. And the fish sometimes were alive in big tanks of water. And I remember being with my mother on a few occasions, walking into a fish store, and my mother might point out, swimming in this great big pool of water, "I want that fish, the one with the spots." "Oh, you mean the codfish? Sure, lady. How much do you want?" And she would say, "Oh, a pound and a half." And the man would pull the fish out, a living fish, and chop its head off right before your eyes. Cut it open, remove the insides, and figure out just about where to place his knife so that he would give you as close to a pound and a half as he could. He would put it on the scale. And generally, he'd come pretty close to that and sell it at whatever the price was. The balance of the fish, the remaining portion of it, he would put on a tray and cover with pieces of ice until the next lady walked in. And perhaps she wanted some of that same fish. And the other thing I would like to tell you before it leaves my memory is milk. Now, milk is something that you take for granted. You probably drink a fair amount of it. And it usually comes in a paper carton. When I was a boy, it was impossible to go to a store and buy milk, because the way it came was in a very heavy glass bottle. And if you were carrying it in a paper bag, and let's say you got caught in the rain and the bag started to get weak, the bottle could fall through the wet paper bag and fall to the ground and break. Besides the mess, you would have lost your money, the money that it had cost. So milk was delivered to every apartment. And believe it or not, it came in a wagon with great big wheels, pulled by a horse. No automobile, a horse. And the wagon was full of chunks of ice to keep the milk cold. And the milkman knew which apartment house to go to and which apartment to leave the milk with. And in front of the door of every house, of every apartment, there was this, well, tin box, which was insulated. And he would leave one or two quarts of milk. That would mean one or two bottles, depending on the order. And he would come very, very early in the morning, so early that the sun wasn't even out yet. And then when the people woke up, the first thing they would do would be go and get the bottle, wash it off, and then put it into a refrigerator? No, because very, very few people had refrigerators. They had a big wooden box, very thick, with a big, heavy, thick door. And inside of it would be a big block of ice. And things that had to be kept cold, like milk, and orange juice, perhaps, or butter, or certain vegetables, would be kept in that box, close by the ice. So that meant that besides the milkman delivering milk, there had to be an iceman delivering ice. I often wonder, where did the ice come from? There were very few refrigerators, if any. Where did they get the ice and how did they make it back then? In 1927 or 1928 or 1929, I really don't know the answer. But I think you might be getting the idea that life then was very different than it is today. There was no such thing as a clothes washing machine. My mother had a great big tub. She filled it with water and soap flakes, little snips and bits of soap. And she had what was called a scrubbing board. It was a piece of wood, and stuck on the wood was a wavy piece of iron, and she would take the clothing and wet it with the soapy water and push the clothes up against the wavy piece of iron and go up and down and back and forth with it. It was called a scrubber. And that's how clothing was cleaned. And in the kitchen, hanging from the ceiling, was a device, a frame, with ropes traveling across the frame. And this whole device was hanging from the ceiling, and a pulley and a rope attached to that. It was almost like Venetian blinds. You know the way you pull up Venetian blinds and it travels over a pulley? Well, you could do the same thing with this dryer. It came down on a rope from the ceiling. My mother would put the wet clothing over the ropes with clothespins. And by now it was pretty heavy because it was wet clothing. And then she would pull on the rope and make it go back up against the ceiling. And it would drip, but she would have an old towel hanging laying on the floor, catching the dripping water. And in time, the clothing would dry. And that's what people did, and that's what people had. And it shows you how life has changed. Now, almost everybody, rich or poor, has a clothes washing machine and a drying machine. In those days, it was all done by hand. And it wasn't because people were poor. It's because there just weren't any machines like that. This was the nature of the world. We had no television. It had not been invented yet. The most important thing, as I remember life back then, was our radio. The radio was to us even more important than a television set would be to you. It was how we heard the news. And instead of watching movies and plays, there were actors and actresses who read their lines in front of a microphone in a radio studio someplace miles away, and played, acted, and of course we couldn't see them, we could only hear them. And we could tell by their voices what their feelings were, if it was anger or happiness. And there were stories for young kids. One of them was Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy, and all his adventures in high school. And there was another program called The Shadow, and it was usually a mystery about a man who could turn invisible, and you could look at him and not see him. The only thing you could see would be his shadow. You'd look right through him. The only evidence of his existence was the shadow on the floor. And all of this, of course, was invisible to us. We just heard the play being acted by actors and actresses. But believe me, Jose, it seemed very, very real. It seemed so real to us. We depended on our imagination to create the picture. Some people today say that they prefer radio to television because the pictures are better. That's sort of a joke, but it really does tell you how people reacted in those days. I think what I'm trying to tell you, Juan, is that people didn't have what they have today, but it wasn't because they were poor. It was because these things just didn't exist. Very few families had telephones, for example. And people had what they called party lines. In order to save money, the phone in your house and the phone in perhaps some other family that you didn't even know, in a building that you had no idea where it was, both shared one telephone number. And you would hear the phone ring and you would run on to answer it. If there was a strange voice of somebody that you didn't know, you knew that that was the other party. That's what they called a party line. And it was your duty to hang up, not to listen in. You could listen in if you wanted to, but the other party, the other person, would know. He'd hear you breathing, and it wasn't the right thing to do. But it's the way most people had telephones. Today, such things don't even exist. Everybody has their own private telephone number. And once again, it had nothing to do with poverty. It was normal. Well, what was the Depression, this Great Depression people are talking about? I don't know how to explain it to you, but something went wrong in the economic system, the money system. And I'll try to tell you some of the things that happened. Even today, scholars and historians who study the Great Depression don't always agree with each other as to what caused it and how it finally stopped. In 1929, when I was 2 years old, the stock market Now, how am I going to explain the stock market to you? It's a place where people buy and sell a document called a stock, a share. People owned shares of manufacturing companies and radio companies and telephone companies and electric companies and automobile manufacturing companies. When you bought a little piece of that company, it was called a share. And the prices of shares suddenly fell. And when that happened, people lost their savings. Other people borrowed money to buy shares of stock in various companies. And when the prices fell, they were unable to pay back the money they had borrowed to buy those shares. Most often, they went to a bank to borrow that money. Very much the way your parents or Jackie and David might go to a bank to borrow money to buy their house, or borrow money to buy an automobile. Well, just think what the bank would say to a man whose stock was suddenly worthless. They'd take away whatever he had to pay back the bank. He might lose his house. Well, things started to get worse. And sometimes a bank would have lent so much money out to people who were buying automobiles and shares of stock and perhaps borrowing money to open a business or for sending their children to college, whatever it might be. They had lent so much money out and people couldn't pay it back that the banks would go out of business. Now stop and think about this one. Suppose you were saving some money. You had a savings account in a bank, and the bank went out of business. Perhaps you had $1,000 in that bank, which represented years and years of savings, and the bank was out of business. That meant that you, Juan, had lost your $1,000. And this is exactly what was happening all over the country. I think the first people to feel it were farmers. Many, many more people in 1927 and 1929 and 30 and around that period, many more people were employed on farms and were engaged in agriculture than they are today. And they were the first people to feel it, because a farmer is constantly borrowing money to buy seed, to plant so that he can get a crop of wheat or corn and then sell it at a profit, or animal feed so that he could raise cows and pigs and send them to market so that they would become food. And if the farmer couldn't pay the debt, well, the farmer lost the farm. It became the property of the bank. And the bank would auction, sell the farm to the highest bidder. And this was getting worse and worse and worse. And nobody knew what to do about it. And there was a president. His name was Herbert Hoover. He was a Republican. And he was in office when all these bad things started to happen. And he and the Republican Party had no answer. They had no idea of how to handle this situation and save people from losing their jobs. Because if you couldn't sell them an automobile, the company would fire the workers. They would no longer have a job. And when they didn't have a job, they couldn't buy clothing. And that meant that clothing factories would go out of business, and stores would go out of business. and it kept going on, and it kept getting worse and worse. And millions of people were without work. And millions of people lost their homes to the banks. I remember that in New York City, on the shore of the Hudson River, there was a whole area which was filled with people with cardboard boxes they used to sleep in, tin houses, old cars that didn't work anymore were used as homes. They lived in terrible poverty. They were starving. And they called the place Hooverville, named after President Hoover. Everybody was very angry with him and with the Republicans because they didn't have a clue what to do. And let's see now how this affected me, because this is what Jackie's questions are all about. How did a young boy feel, and what did he see during those terrible years, and how did it affect my family? But I had to tell you the background. I had to tell you what was going on so that the answers would make some sense to you. Well, you have to take into consideration how young I was, how little a child my age could understand of it. Just think of Sam, who's only 5 years old. How could you explain all that to him? I simply didn't know what was going on, but I did know that something was terribly, terribly wrong. My father was terribly worried. I believe, to the best of my recollection, he had lost his job. I don't know exactly what that job was, but I know he was out of work. And back in those days, there was no such thing as unemployment insurance. There was no such thing as food stamps. There was no such thing as welfare. The government did nothing to help people. You were really in bad shape, and they didn't even have food stamps. And how would a father feed his family? Where could he get a job? People would read the want ads of newspapers looking for work, and there were no advertisements in there. Nobody was hiring anybody. The fact is, to the best of my knowledge, maybe 2 out of every 4 people, maybe 50% of all the workers in the United States were out of a job, and they got no help from the government. And things began to turn very ugly. There were a lot of things in the United States that weren't good, not just the Great Depression. But this was a young country then. It was still had a lot to learn. And it was a terrible time to be a black person or an immigrant from some other country, because people were very angry. They didn't understand what was happening to them. They were truly suffering, and they had to find somebody to blame. And who better to blame than minority people? And things were just awful, awful. If my family suffered, it wasn't anything like being an immigrant. It wasn't anything like being a black person. And they weren't welcome. Immigration into the United States was virtually non-existent. First of all, nobody in his right mind would want to come here. because there wasn't any work. But in Europe and in Asia, everywhere, South America, it was just as bad. The whole world was facing this Great Depression. I have a friend the same age as I am. His family lived in the Bronx too. I didn't know him then, but his experience was similar to ours. When he wore out a pair of shoes, you know, the sole of the shoe started showing a hole. Well, today you just go and don't give it a thought, you just buy another pair of shoes. Not back then, you didn't have any money. You would take a piece of cardboard and cut out the shape of the shoe and stuff it on the inside to protect your feet and sort of keep the hole from letting water in if it was raining. People's shoes were falling apart. Their clothes were getting raggedy. Most men didn't have money enough to buy shaving cream or a razor blade, and their faces got very stubbly. They weren't growing beards, but they would save their razors because they thought, well, maybe I'll get a chance to go and interview, go on an interview to get a job, and then I'll need to have my face freshly shaved. So for the whole week or two, like my father, his face was all stubbly because he was hoping that maybe he would get a chance to speak to a potential employer. And this was true of most of the fathers I knew. Jackie asked me how it affected our family. Well, I, as a very young boy, about 4 years old, we could not pay the rent in our apartment. My father was out of work. We went to live with my grandmother, my mother's mother, my grandma. And I don't know how long we lived there. It was in the Bronx. I remember very vaguely. It probably was near the Botanical Gardens someplace. And my grandmother was being supported by her sons and daughters. Each one contributed to her to pay the bills, to pay the rent. And we were in the worse shape than anybody else in the family. And we had to go and live with her. And I don't know how long that lasted. I was much too young to really know that. But I do remember the experience of having to move out and live with a woman who was very old and very much a stranger to me. But I was young, and it really didn't hurt me very much. But I could see the look on my father's face. He was not very happy. That's for sure. Well, the Depression lasted something like 10 years. In a moment, I'll explain why things started getting better. They didn't get better for everybody all at once. They started getting better slowly. And here and there, some jobs were coming. And here's what happened. Herbert Hoover, the President of the United States, had approximately 2 more years of his term remaining. And he had no idea what to do. And there was an election in 1932, as I remember. And of course, everybody, just about everywhere, voted Herbert Hoover out of office and elected a new president, a Democrat. His name was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he had a program. He had ideas that he thought would turn things around and make the Depression stop and get jobs for people. I don't want to spend a lot of time telling you all the things he did, but I'll just name a few. He created a government agency called the WPA, Works Progress Administration. The government started building roads. The government started building office buildings and some housing projects. And of course, this took labor. So some people were getting hired. The money was coming from the United States government. Republicans thought this was terrible. The government is going to go broke. It doesn't have the money. There is not enough money out there from taxes because people couldn't pay their taxes. How in the world is he going to help things? But Roosevelt had a good working majority in Congress, and the WPA was starting to help. Some people were going back and getting jobs. And when you start building houses, you start employing people who are painters and plumbers and steel workers and all that sort of carpenters, you know. So some work was being done, and some people were getting their jobs back. My father had a great piece of luck come his way. He was really fortunate. One of the things that the government was doing was, besides building roads, they were building highways and bridges and all sorts of things. And they were buying people's homes to make way for these government projects. And my father got a job with a lawyer. And this lawyer specialized in arranging with private people to have them sell their houses to the government at a reasonable price. This lawyer represented the homeowners who had to sell. The government has the right to buy your house, but it has the obligation to pay you a fair price. And if there's a difference of opinion as to what the house is worth and what the government ought to pay the owner for, there would be a law case, and it's called condemnation. This may be a little ahead of you. I know this is all new to you, but my father worked for this lawyer, helped him, helped the lawyer figure out the value of the house, and appeared as a witness, and he had a job, thank goodness. Well, things got a little better for us, and the lawyer was getting to be a rich man because he had so much business with all these government projects. Our lives were changing rapidly and for the better. We were very, very lucky. Now, Jackie asked me to tell you how the Depression, some of the things I remember most, some of the most important memories I have. While things were getting a little better for us, we were still living on the second floor of an apartment house. But not everybody was as lucky as we were. And I remember we were able to walk home from school to have lunch at home. Most people, most boys and girls, lived very close to their school. And I remember often seeing my classmates with their mothers and fathers out on the street with their furniture and their clothing, everything they owned, They had been thrown out of their apartments by the landlord because they didn't have money for the rent. And I remember seeing them and how bewildered they looked and how they would turn their eyes away. Boys and girls that I used to play with in the schoolyard, they would pretend they didn't know me. They felt so ashamed, and I felt so terrible. And that's how it was. Day after day, we would see people we knew out on the street. And you know, Juan, I am so old a man, and yet sometimes I still have dreams that are about the Great Depression and the things I saw as a young boy. President Roosevelt did quite a few things to make the Depression go away. For one thing, he declared a bank holiday. People didn't trust the banks anymore, and they would withdraw their savings from the banks because they felt that maybe the bank would go out of business and they'd lose what money they had there. That was called a run on the bank. So Roosevelt declared a bank holiday. At the same time, the Congress of the United States passed a law that insured every bank account up to $10,000. $10,000 back in the 1930s was a huge amount of money, more than most people had. But it gave people confidence that even if the bank were to go out of business, the government would make good and pay the person back for what the bank owed him. And that brought a certain amount of confidence to the people. And the run on the banks began to stop. That helped a lot, because then the banks were able to start lending money out again, and people were able to replace their old automobiles. And that started sending people back to work in the factories, the automobile factories. And then he did some things that helped the farmers. I can't recall exactly what they were, but he helped ensure that farmers would get a good price for the crops they grew, which gave them confidence to stay in business and gave them confidence to borrow money so they could buy seed and plant food. And he started paying people who were out of work unemployment insurance. I think you would get $20 a week, as I remember, if you lost your job. And that gave people some confidence. But the Depression was never really finished. Roosevelt never really conquered it, in my opinion. Something else happened. In 1939, a war broke out in Europe. Germany invaded Poland. France and England declared war on Germany because they were afraid of what the Germans were going to do once they conquered a weak country like Poland. And these foreign countries were buying food from American farmers. They were buying ammunition, guns, and people in the United States started working. And all of this was on credit because the British and the French didn't have enough money to pay for this stuff. But the American government under Roosevelt encouraged banks to lend these foreign countries money. Because Hitler, the leader of Germany, was considered to be a great threat to all of civilization. He was probably one of the most evil men that ever lived. and England and France were fighting for their lives. And they were old allies of the United States. So the war in Europe caused more employment in the United States, and the Depression started to lift, and eventually the Japanese in 1941 attacked Pearl Harbor, which is in Hawaii, and they sank some American naval ships. They killed 3,000 American sailors on one battleship alone. And when that happened, we found ourselves at war with Japan, and the Congress voted to go to war against Japan and Germany and their allies, Italy and Japan. And this is all another subject, which I'm sure you'll learn about at some other time. But what I suppose I'm telling you is that the war in Europe and the United States getting into war gave people jobs, and prosperity came back to the United States. By 1942, we were deep in war, and almost everybody had a job, but most of those jobs were based on war products like ammunition and rifles and ships and fighting airplanes and uniforms and all the things that a country needs for a war. And there was no unemployment, just about zero unemployment. And the Depression was over. In 1941, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, I was 14 years old. And I think I can say that my life was totally different from that point on. There was no such thing as people being thrown out of their apartments because they didn't have money. They had money. They had jobs. And the war went on until 1945, I believe. And it lasted long enough for even me to go into the Air Force. It was the biggest war in human history. Millions and millions of people died, but it brought prosperity to the United States and eventually victory over its enemies. And my life changed for the better, and so did everybody else's. That is, if you weren't a soldier or a sailor fighting for your life against the enemies. History is very strange. It is weird to think that this country became rich because millions of its people had to fight a horrible war. Sometimes one person does well and another does poorly, and it has nothing to do with their character. It has nothing to do with how hard they work. It has to do, I guess, with luck or bad luck. The Depression was one horrendous, horrendous thing. There were many homeless people. You could walk out during the Depression years, and there were men who were called hobos. They were really men who had lost all hope. There were no jobs for them. They used to ride railroad trains, you know, in the cattle cars, going from one place to another, not really knowing where the train would even let them off. They had no idea when they jumped on these trains where they were going. Their hope was to get off somewhere, maybe find a job, leaving their wives and children behind. Many of them never got back to their families. I remember one rainy day, I will never forget this. a classmate of mine. I think I was in third grade. I was looking out the window of my second floor apartment, and I heard two voices singing in the rain. I looked out, and there was my classmate and his father, and they were singing in the alleyway between two houses. They were begging, and people would throw coins out the window, and they would catch the coins in their hats, and they went down the street that way. People just like us, reduced to begging in the street. Some fathers I knew were selling pencils on street corners, trying to make a few pennies to buy enough food. I suppose that what I carry around with me to this very day is fear, being afraid of bad finances, of bad luck. All the years I worked, I think I can truly say I always had the feeling in the back of my neck somewhere that I could lose my job. And while most people would say, so I'll get another job, what of it? I would feel, wow, maybe I'll be on the street corner selling pencils. Many people had terrible times, worse than my family, and sometimes better. I think my family's experience was average. And for that, I'd say, we were pretty darn lucky. That's how the thing affected me. In 1941, we had just moved into our own house in Yonkers. My father was making enough money then to put down a down payment and get a loan from a bank and build a very modest little house with two bedrooms, one for my mother and father and one for me. It had a living room, it had one bathroom, it had a basement and a garage. Oh yes, by that time my father owned his own car. Today people own two cars, families own two cars, sometimes three cars. That was the first year, as I recall, my father actually owned and drove a car that belonged to him. Were we poor? Well, maybe so, but not when you compare us to other people, to most people. Looking back, I guess I've seen a lot, and I'm still figuring it out. Oh, Juan, life is very strange. I hope you have a good life. I hope you have prosperity, a good job. I hope when you grow up, you find a very nice girl who'll marry you and you'll have nice children and maybe a dog and your own home. What everybody hopes for, the great American dream. But in those years, that is 10 or so years of the Great Depression, that dream turned into a nightmare. And to this very day, I can remember the details. In making this tape, I get the feeling of what it was like all over again. It was horrible. But it's past, and I don't think it will ever happen again, because the laws that were enacted during the Roosevelt time will soften, I think, the worst downturn. We're hearing news these days about people being laid off, about people losing their jobs, about companies going out of business, about the stock market going down. It reminds me so much of what was happening all those years ago. Well, Good luck, Juan. I wish you a good life and to your family. I hope this tape was good and answers any questions you have. God bless you, Juan, and your family. I hope you got something out of this tape. Goodbye.